You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
It's about 90% of scripts never see the light of day. So how do we get more films made? How do we help storyboard concepts? How do we bring ideas to life, leveraging this technology that's allowing people to do more with less?
Yeah, a lot of people be aware of AI and what's sort of happening at the very surface level. You're going a level or two deeper in the industry. What are you seeing? How are people reacting?
Real focus is going to be, how can we leverage this new technology to push the bounds of what's possible? So areas that we really like to work on, you know, things like dream sequences, surrealism, blending horror films, you know, blending traditional creative methods with the kind of power of AI to unlock that next frontier.
What are some of the things you've seen founders get wrong about seeding liquidity into two or three-sided marketplaces?
Basically, every industry is about to go through its own kind of internet-style revolution as they start to embrace and actually unlock the power of these tools to their full potential.
Welcome back to Diaspora.nz, where we're on a mission to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. Today, we're chatting with Xavier Collins. Xavier is a London-born, New Zealand-raised founder of Wanda, a brand new AI-native creative studio that's come out of stealth this week with backing from Blackbird, Local Globe, and a lineup of world-class angels. Excited to see this hit the press, but there's a lot more under the surface. I've been hanging out to get Xavier on the pod for a long time. His career reads like a masterclass in tech-enabled marketplaces. He cut his teeth early at Uber and then went on to co-found Nexus Notes, a peer-to-peer learning platform, before joining Deliveroo early in the UK to lead marketplace expansion from London to dozens of UK cities and new markets, and then took over the reins at Turo, launching the car-sharing giant into Europe and scaling the UK operation from, you know, cold start to $60 million in revenue. In today's conversation, we try to weave these threads together. We talk shop on what makes marketplace work, how to think about the supply side quality to find and measure the user experience and demand, through to what it takes to seed liquidity from scratch. He brings all of that and more to Wanda, where he's now fusing the storytelling, creative tooling, generative AI models, and community to unleash a new wave of creativity and let more voices be heard. This is an awesome episode. Excited to hear your feedback. As usual, feel free to forward this on to a founder who's interested in the space. Hit reply with any interesting expats that should be on our radar. Our mission is to track them down and keep them in the loop and build community around these epic New Zealanders out and around the world. And here's my conversation with Xavier Collins. Xavier Collins, it's a pleasure to have you on the Diaspora podcast. It feels like a long time coming with this one. Also have Sam Wong joining as a co-host. Really exciting. I know you guys had a journey through Startmate, through your Aussie days together, so want to blend some of those in. But welcome, Zav. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You know, my favorite first question, I want to hear, I mean, once this episode is released, you've just announced Wanda, your new startup. It's exciting. It's big round. It's a big deal. It's a huge space. But I wanted you to take us back to the, what is the moment that you realized this was possible?
Great questions. Yeah. So obviously surreal to be kind of on the cusp of announcing this and to think this will, it will be live when this goes out. Very, very cool. Obviously very excited and honored to have Blackbird pilot round alongside Local Globe and some great world-class angels. Yeah, super surreal to see it kind of come to life. I think the moment we realized we were onto something was when I was sitting with my co-founder, Justin Hackney, who's he was a kind of traditional filmmaker and creative who went on to work at 11 Labs as their creative director. And we were both sitting at the Cannes Film Festival. I was there for my film rights business, working on buying some foreign rights to some American films. And he was there with 11 Labs. And we were catching up over like some rosé in the sun, as one does at the Cannes Film Festival. And we were talking about all things AI, like, you know, I'm a kind of philosophy nerd and we were talking about morality and ethics and what does AI mean, all this kind of stuff. And then he showed me a video clip of a film he'd made using the tools called Alice in Wonderland, a kind of promotional trailer for Alice in Wonderland, the film. And I was just completely blown away. Like, it was one of those classic moments. I was like, I can't believe this is AI. How have you done this? And so then and there, we sent it to the CEO of a big production company who I'd worked with historically. And they came back straight away and they're like, this is incredible. Could we use this to create a teaser? And so kind of then and there, before we'd even set up a company, we had our first customer and it was a major Hollywood production studio, independent film studio. So yeah, that was kind of how it all started. It was like a crazy moment of like, I just saw it as instantly and was like, this is going to change the game.
Yeah, I've heard you say before, you're working at the intersection of AI, storytelling, what's going on around you. So yeah, a lot of people be aware of AI and what's sort of happening at the very surface level. You're going a level or two deeper in the industry. What are you seeing? How are people reacting?
Yeah, so I think the way we try and explain what we do is, I love analogies, so you have to forgive me for the labored analogies probably throughout this whole podcast. But
I love them.
There's the AI gold rush that's happening right now. You've got OpenAI, you've got X, DeepMind, et cetera, extracting the gold. You've got NVIDIA that are selling the picks and shovels. And the way I like to think about Wonder is we're like the jewelers, we're the artisans, we're the people who are crafting the gold into a product that people are ultimately consuming. And when I think about that analogy, you don't just make fine jewelry with gold. You know, you actually weave in and blend together different materials. And so, you know, we're pretty passionate about the fact that we think this technology can unlock a whole new world of creativity and actually support a lot of traditional artists, traditional filmmakers. And so I think about the jewelry analogy in terms of how can we start to blend in the gold, which is the AI, you know, AI and harnessing some of this technology with traditional creators, traditional storytellers, and doing multiple things. You know, I think one, it's about 90% of scripts never see the light of day. So how do we get more films made? How do we help storyboard concepts? How do we bring ideas to life, leveraging this technology that's allowing people to do more with less? But then the second point is, you know, I think in terms of what we're seeing is there's obviously resistance in some parts, but by and large, you know, I think a lot of creatives are realizing that this technology can supercharge their potential. And I think the interesting kind of anecdote there is that typically when a new art form comes along, people are really obsessed with, you know, can this capture reality? How can we make this look as real as possible? And so there's a lot of focus on the uncanny valley and how can we use AI to recapture what we see with our eyes. I think we're going to get over that. And I think the real focus is going to be how can we leverage this new technology to push the bounds of what's possible. So areas that we really like to work on, you know, things like dream sequences, surrealism, you know, blending horror films, you know, blending traditional creative methods with the kind of power of AI to unlock that next frontier.
There's two things I love there. One, I mean, lots of it, but in particular, I mean, the idea that 90% of scripts never see the light of day. And one of the reasons for that would be the costs involved or the sort of the overhead involved in producing a trailer or producing something that a studio might want to pick up. You bring down those costs, more scripts see the light of day, the world sees more creativity. That's awesome. I mean, the idea of, you're right, you're not trying to use this new technology to create what already exists and replace the people that already create what already exists. You're trying to imagine what's possible for new content forms.
Exactly. I mean, we're trying to save digital industry, actually. You know, I think I've got a lot of friends who are filmmakers. I mean, Justin himself, he was like a young BAFTA-winning filmmaker. He was an actor. My co-founder, he kind of comes from that world. You know, we're definitely passionate about seeing these industries flourish, seeing what's happening. You know, people are under a lot of pressure to do more with less. It's getting harder and harder to raise finance for films. And so it's not even about reducing costs sometimes. It's about unlocking projects. So, you know, one of the things we get out when we work with traditional industry is how can we help storyboard a concept, right? How can we bring an idea to life without having to invest, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions in basically shooting it and then realizing, you know what, we don't want to go that direction. We can kind of be like a partner early on in the creative development process to help map out exactly what this scene could look like, what this film could look like. So there's obviously a bunch of stuff around, you know, empowering people to do more with less and using the tools to be more cost efficient. But actually there's a whole other piece around, you know, just helping the vision side of that process be more efficient and more creative.
I want to ask a lot more about the financing. I want to ask more about the industry and what's happening next. I also want to go back in time because you were born in New Zealand. You've come a long way since then, spent some time in Australia. Take us for a really quick run through the timeline. And there's a few points we want to jump in as well. I know that you first crossed paths with Sam and Ozzy. So take us back there.
I was actually born in London, believe it or not. Born in London and then spent the first couple of years here where I live now. Back and then I moved to France when I was 7. My mum's Kiwi, and then I moved from France to New Zealand when I was 12 and went to school in New Zealand and was there for like about 6-7 years. Obviously a lot of my friends are there, a lot of my kind of grew up there. I think when I think about where I grew up, I said New Zealand. And then when I left school, I moved to Sydney, went to law school at Sydney University, then got involved in startups. I was kind of interning at Uber when they were just setting up, handing out flyers and doing Uber ice cream and all that kind of crazy stuff. And then was lucky enough to meet a guy called Hugh Minson and start something called Nexus Nodes, which is what took me into Startmate. That's where I met Sam Wong and spent a bunch of great, you know, time with her and the rest of the Startmate team kind of trying to build my first business.
I think it's worth like slow rolling a little bit some of the steps that led to you kind of joining Nexus Nodes, because it's a not necessarily a non-obvious step to go from like grad at UCID Law School, which is very prestigious, to, you know, one of a team of four at a startup. And there was a really interesting story, as I recall, about like what got you there. Like, why didn't you end up in a big firm? Why did not any of the other typical paths be the one that you took?
You obviously know my story well. So it definitely turned almost like on a knife's edge. Like when I was at law school, obviously the big thing that everyone aims for is like, can they go work at a top investment bank, law firm, consultancy group? And I ended up clerking at Freehills, funny enough, which I ended up kind of turning down to do the whole Nexus thing. But even before that, I remember there was like a BCG scholarship, like a Boston Consulting Group scholarship. It was a $30,000 scholarship. Or, you know, thousands of people applied to it. And, you know, I never really thought I would have a shot at it, to be honest. But I had a very smart friend who went on to be a partner at McKinsey who kind of coached me through how to answer those questions. And so I applied for the scholarship and ended up going through all the rounds and getting to the very final round. Now, about 6 months earlier, Hugh, the original founder CEO of Nexus, had come to my college and put up a bunch of posters on the walls talking about how he wanted people to help him get university notes. It was a university notes marketplace where people could upload content and other students could buy it. And I saw this poster and I just loved the idea. And I obviously, growing up in New Zealand, I was like, I can help. You know, I sent him an email straight away. I would love to be part of this. I would love to help launch it in New Zealand. Here's my details. I can help you get 500 notes, no time at all, kind of thing. I never heard back from him. Never heard back. It went into the ether. I never heard anything back. Anyway, so I go through this BCG process and I get to the final round and there's a question and it's like about a paper pulp mill in Tasmania or something. And it's all going great. It's with the managing director of APAC. And then there's suddenly like an algebra question and my mind just kind of goes blank. And he could tell that I was struggling. He's like, it's okay, don't worry. Like, just which one is the numerator and which one's the denominator? And honestly, like I wasn't like terrible at math, but my mind just went completely blank. I had no idea. And I knew I screwed it like in that moment. So anyway, he shakes my head. I say goodbye. And I'm walking along a street. I remember exactly where I was. I was in Glebe in New South Wales and the sun was shining. And I get this phone call and it's the managing director of APAC. And he's like, look, you did so well. You were in the final two people. We really like you, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you really screwed up that question. And I was like, I know. And he's like, we can't give you the scholarship. But, you know, please apply next year, XYZ. So, you know, I was obviously pretty gutted. I remember just being like, oh, can't believe I messed that up. Put the phone down. And then 5 seconds later, my phone rings again. And I just assume he's calling me back to be like, but, you know, actually, don't worry. And I pick up the phone and it's this guy, Humans, a good day, mate. Very kind of Ocker, Adelaide guy. He's like, got your email, loved it. Was thinking like, do you want to come over this weekend? Come to the garage and we can talk about Nexus Nodes and how we can help launch in Australia and then maybe New Zealand one day. And I thought, you know what? Like, I was like, the timing of this call, man, you just nailed it. Like, I was like, I'll be there. What's your address? And the rest is basically history. The rest of my life kind of turned on that moment and I went down the startup path very thankfully.
I mean, it feels a face, right?
A little bit, yeah.
It's meant to be.
Saved from consulting.
Absolutely.
I know you're probably going to shift into Startmate era Nexus Nodes, but one of the reasons why I love Zave so much and I'm so excited that he's become a founder is, you know, Startmate was excellent at aggregating super hustly young people, but Xavier took hustle to like the next level and like would love you to share some of the kind of anecdotes of kind of trying to kickstart in the marketplace in, you know, Texas and all sorts of places.
I want to hear those anecdotes, and I want to hang them on kind of this framework as well, Zev, because I remember you told me once that in those early days, somewhere along the line, there was an Uber internship, right? Or there was a first exposure to marketplaces. There was Nexus Notes is obviously a supplier and demand marketplace, and then you've gone on to critical early role at Deliveroo, launching new marketplaces. You went on to Turo, leading the entire UK business, which is a marketplace. So like, there is a common thread here. You have to hustle to start marketplaces. Right. Tell us about it. Why in form of your enjoyable journey?
You definitely have to hustle to start marketplaces. I think that's a very fair comment. I think, one of the things I learned from Andre, who's the CEO of Turo, and I think also, to be honest, Will from Deliveroo said similar things, but Andre kind of drilled it into me the most, is you also just need quality on the supply side to start a marketplace. So, I could talk to you guys about marketplaces for hours. I love marketplace businesses so much, but It's like you need hustle. It's like you're getting over the cold start. You really just need to like pour your life energy into like making it happen. But I think you need to have hustle orientated around like a smart strategy. And that to me is, how do you build high quality supply? And you have to really understand like, what does quality look like in the context of your marketplace? But I can go into that later. But yeah, I think, in terms of StartMade stories and like that kind of going from zero to one, I think my favorite thing about marketplaces and that whole experience, it's actually my favorite startup story, is when we like, I think of marketplaces like a giant psychological experiment. It sounds crazy, but like, you kind of come up with this idea and then you just put it into the wild and you just hope that two completely random people like have a meeting of minds, and in this case it's money is the kind of like signaler of like the transaction working. But for me, it's way more about like, do you have an idea where like two completely separate people or companies, two distinct entities interact because you've created some kind of value? And it's just this like fascinating idea. And when I was at StartMate, I'll go into the Austin stuff, but before I kind of packed my bags and went couch surfing around America trying to start this business, we were in the StartMate building back then, which is kind of near Redfern. And we'd spent honestly, weeks trying to build up our supply. We wanted to launch America, and we spent weeks trying to build our supply of authors on the platform. If authors for Nexus was like, high quality students, the students who took really good notes, they would put them up onto the platform, other students would want to buy them. And so I was going onto LinkedIn, and to this day, I think the reason I've got so many LinkedIn connections isn't because of anything I've actually done or posted. It's more to do with the fact that I was just frantically connecting with students from the University of Austin. But I would connect with all these students, and I would get on these phone calls, and I would pitch them on the benefits of Nexus and try and get them to upload their notes to the site. And I remember sitting one day in the office, like quite late, and just talking to the team and saying, like, I just wonder if like anyone will ever buy these notes in America. Like, we just had no idea if it would work. We had no idea. Obviously now ChatGPT has completely destroyed that business model, but back in the day that wasn't available. And so, we had the strong sense that the idea would work, but there was just no proof. And I remember as I was saying to the team, I just don't know if someone's going to do this. I was watching Google Analytics and I was watching people on the site just like so obsessively interested on like what was working and where people were dropping off. And as I was speaking, I saw someone go from like search, note page, checkout. And I just remember the exact moment when the first customer in the US bought this set of notes. And it was like, I don't know, it was just this incredible moment. I just got the bug. I already had the bug, but I think as soon as that happened, I never looked back. But in terms of the hustle, from that, I then shipped out to Austin. Like, I basically couch surfed around Texas before couch surfing was even really a thing. I don't even know if it is a thing now, but I was basically living for free on people's couches. I ran into one pretty unfortunate incident with a lady who wore a panda suit everywhere. Nothing bad happened, but it was probably...
Do we need that story for the pod? I think
probably
so.
Not. Yeah, I don't think it's not. But I think that kind of broke my patience with sleeping on couches. And after that, the team let me get like a cheap Airbnb. But yeah, I loved it. It was all about going somewhere, starting something from zero, and just making it happen.
The anecdote about, or your recollection of that first checkout flow going from search to notes to checkout, is there something in that sort of you then obviously went into Deliveroo? It's all about optimizing the interaction between an individual looking to buy some food, you know, minimizing the experience through making sure they've got the right supply on the other side, or to what extent do you also need to focus on the supply side? So if you think about that person, they're on the demand side of a marketplace, you've got to make sure you've got the localized, high quality supply on the other side. What are you thinking about first?
Always the supply. I mean, I've never lost that passion or like buzz when the first marketplace transaction happens. I've been lucky enough to kind of do it for 4 businesses, you know, many of which went on to become really big businesses. I think, you know, I joined Deliveroo in the first 30 people. I was a general manager for those guys. I used to run the south of the UK and then rattle their market launches. But when I joined, I would go to these restaurants in the south of the UK, and I would go with the backpacks. I'd be carrying the backpacks, and I'd be carrying the tablet in the backpack, and I would go and sign up the restaurant owner, who had no idea what Deliveroo was and had every reason under the sun why they didn't want to do it. Then I would meet the riders in the restaurant to, you know, maximize efficiency, and I would give the riders the backpack and show them how the app worked, you know, and that would be like a good day. Sign up a restaurant and sign up like 3 riders in a day, and I used to do a presentation to the team where we would measure on the same axes the number of restaurant signs and the number of riders signed. Obviously, you know, I was there for 3 years, and by the end of my time there, it was like I used to manage over 6,000 riders, and we were doing, you know, over 10,000 orders a day. But I remember just in my region, I'm sure it was, you know, multiples of that globally. But I still remember like the first order in a market, the exact same with Tura, obviously. And I think it starts, you know, super tactically, it starts with high quality supply. In Deliveroo's case, it's a 3-sided marketplace. So that's why I gave that story. You know, you sign up the restaurant, you sign up the rider, and the customers will come. I think if you, with something like Deliveroo, it was easy to leverage the restaurants because ultimately, you know, they have their own customers, and you're solving for a problem that people already have, which is like, I love this particular product. I love this restaurant. I wish I could have it delivered.
So I love the call out, the 3-sided marketplace. Yes, the 2-sided marketplace. So Tura is 2-sided because you've really got people who own cars and people who want to rent cars. What are the things that you've seen in your, I know that we're going to move into some of your angel investing and advising and supporting startups more recently as well. What are some of the things you've seen founders get wrong about seeding liquidity into 2 or 3-sided marketplaces?
You know, I think what I always see is people come with like an arbitrary number. You know, I'm going to sound like a broken record. It's like people fail to understand sometimes like what is good supply. And so often people will be like, oh, we're going to get to 100. So Tura, for people's benefit, is like, it's basically Airbnb for cars, 2-sided marketplace. People who have a car who want to share it out when they're not using it can basically rent it to guests, you know, to customers who want to book it. You know, I think there's a lot of inclination from people to be like, we're going to get to 100 cars in search, we're going to get to 20 restaurants in search, and then we're going to launch. And, you know, it's like, it's kind of like a vanity metric, or it's a useful like heuristic, but it hides the reality of what a true marketplace business is, which is, have you really understood from your customer's perspective what quality supply looks like? Because when you've nailed that, you tend to find product market fit, and it tends to grow exponentially. So the example I always give, you know, I'll give you 2. I think at Deliveroo, it was about the brand names of the restaurants. You know, we knew as soon as we closed the Wagamama or a Nando's or like the local burger joint, there was one in back in the day called 7 Bone. I remember that, were just like, as soon as we got it, we knew we've solved a problem here. We've got the product that people want. We'll have product market fit. And I think, you know, different in Turo's case, but like, it was never about getting 100 cars. Now, there's definitely considerations that go into things like proximity, convenience. You know, if you don't have enough sheer volume, then you obviously have a problem. But volume alone isn't the solution. And so we would do things like, we'd invest up front in professional photography. We would personally coach the first hosts on the marketplace to make sure that they gave an incredible experience. You know, so that's how I think about it. It's like, not about numbers. It's about super, super high quality, really good user experience from a demand perspective.
Yeah, I love that framing of it's about quality supply, and then it's about the photos, it's about coaching the supplier. I mean, it's going to be so different for every business that's building it's also about like quality suppliers relates to the specific individual customer. So like one, you know, young customer in, you know, university town's quality supplier might be Nando's, whereas, you know, one, you know, more affluent customer in the, you know, middle of, you know, Southwest London's quality supply might be a fancy restaurant. I assume that there'd be some sort of deep analytical, you know, tracking of those and targeting, and you're going into a district or you're going into a new area, you'll be signing up the right suppliers based on the demographic that you're targeting. Would that be right, or is there something more to it?
Probably now there's like deep analytical frameworks and rigor around it. Back then there wasn't. You know, it was definitely more of a gut instinct thing than like a data driven decision. It definitely evolved over time. Don't get me wrong. I remember there were many like reports on that. I think the thing that Will Shrew drilled into me and the company was price, selection, service. Those are like the three vectors upon which you compete and you succeed. And it was so drilled into me that it was the, and I can say this now because I'm sure they've changed it, the Wi-Fi password at Turo's European HQ was price, selection, service, because I wanted to make sure that...
Kind of want to go check if it hasn't changed
yeah,
yet.
Yeah, yeah. No, they changed it.
Price, selection, service, yep.
If you think about it that way, so first of all, price doesn't mean the cheapest, it means value for money. You know, is this product good value for money? That's a fundamental question I think founders who are building in marketplaces have to ask themselves, and they have to put themselves in the position of the customer. It's not a race to the bottom. It's just like, do you represent good value for money? Selection, that's to your point of like, for the university who wants Nando's, or for the, you know, young professional who wants something healthy, you know, on a late night, like, do you have a good selection? Because selection drives conversion. And then service is like convenience, or how good is the product? Like if I click order, like will the food be with me in 25 minutes? And will you be reliable in your timing? And it's the exact same for Turo. It's like, you know, is the car well priced? Is it good value for money? Is there a good selection? Are there Teslas? Are there like electric cars? Are there Defenders for like the outdoors? Are there people movers? And is it convenient? Like, can I press a button and get the car?
Xavier, I remember when we spoke once about your marketplace's thesis more broadly, there was this idea that you can have a marketplace that's, I'd say, fungible. It doesn't really matter, you know, what Uber picks you up, so long as it's a clean car and it gets you from A to B. It doesn't really matter which driver picks up your Deliveroo, so long as they get it from A to B. It does matter at the other end of that spectrum. It really matters. Like if you think about a marketplace for babysitters, say, it really matters who the babysitter is. You really care about who they are. And so as a result of that, you have different marketplace dynamics. In the former case, you know, it's a lot easier to launch and present a lot more option. In the latter case, you know, it's a lot harder, I think, to sort of to build the marketplace dynamic and to keep people coming back and to using the marketplace for more as opposed to deplatforming, moving off. I'm really curious about how you've sort of seen that dynamic play out as you've transitioned into this creative field. I want to start throwing some connections back, because what you're doing now, it's somewhat a creative marketplace. You're thinking about, you know, underutilized resources, that their scripts, 90% of which are sitting in a dusty drawer somewhere, and you are connecting those scripts on the people who wrote them with studios and people with the capacity to publish them, but they're very, very fungible. They're very unique. So is there a marketplace element to Wanda in the business you're building today, or am I sort of projecting that?
I'd say there's definitely a marketplace element to Wanda, but I'd frame it this way. So Wanda is an AI native creative studio, right? So we're kind of interested in doing a couple of things, the chief of which is developing and producing world-class original content, right? Developing IP, telling amazing stories, harnessing the power of AI to supercharge those stories and to supercharge the creative process. That's fundamentally what we're about. And we're doing that, and here comes the marketplace element, underpinned by a community. So my co-founder, Justin, built, you know, over 3 years talking about like hustle and going 0 to 1. He invested all of his kind of life savings into creating a community, putting on events around the world, connecting different creatives, storytellers, and AI technologists. This community is called Real Dreams. It still runs today. It's super active. And that community, talent, and emerging filmmakers is really what underpins Wanda. Because in essence, Wanda is there to basically unearth and discover the top talent, the next generation of filmmaking talent, and help them bring their films to life, whether that's a purely AI concept or it's a traditional blend of, you know, industry, traditional storytelling and technology. There's also, you know, obviously we are a business, and in addition to the IP, there's, we think, a huge opportunity to kind of service needs. I think this technology is, it's kind of changing the game for advertising, TV commercials, music videos, to your point, teasers and scripts and trailers and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, a big part of what we're doing as Wonder on the more commercial side is basically connecting the best people in our ecosystem and our community with the right projects. Let's just say, for example, a big TV commercial comes in. You know, we will basically manage and deliver that brief like an agency, but an agency that's supercharged through not only the technology and the kind of custom models we're building to do that at scale, but through the talent that we're plugging into. And you're right, like that talent isn't fungible. It's, you know, it's like we're really focusing on high quality premium talent.
I think that's the thread I was trying to pull at, which is the individual creative, which you end up connecting to a studio to work on the specific project. That's a, like, that's such a an important connection, and who it is and what they've done before really, really matters. So there is a point at which, like, as a marketplace, you're going to be able to create a huge amount of value by creating that unique connection between them. And then beyond that, you know, maybe they do a lot more work together, and over time it's harder for you to sort of to own and you know, retain that value on the platform or the marketplace. Now, I don't think it matters so much, because there's another really interesting trend here, which is you're not just building AI tooling to generate the content, you're actually generating the content yourself. I've heard you describe this as sort of somewhat of an agency. I'd love you to talk about this whole idea. It's quite recent. Yeah, technology companies used to be about building technology. With AI and the amount that you can actually do, in many cases, you're seeing people actually provide the end service, and in some cases, compete with people that they would previously have sold the technology to. So here, you are creating content and selling it directly to the studios, which is an exciting opportunity. Do you see others across sort of other sectors and spaces doing the same with AI? How do you think about, you know, those trade-offs, the building tech versus the delivering services with the tech you've built?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, I think first and foremost, we're like an IP generation company, actually. You know, this is kind of a cliche expression, but we want to be A24 of the AI revolution, right? We want to be the kind of next frontier studio blending traditional talent with AI. And we think that's going to allow us to create at scale. Now, obviously, we're doing a lot of stuff under the hood to make that possible in terms of what we're investing in and the processes and the technology to make creation possible at scale. But first and foremost, I think we're like, how do we basically shape the future of entertainment, create really high quality IP, and be a studio? That's kind of where we're going at it. On the services versus kind of SaaS conversation, I think it's a really interesting conversation for what it's worth. And, you know, I think agency is maybe like a dirty word amongst the VC community, but I've worked for many cash burning, highly expensive businesses that need like mega scale to succeed. And I think that we're on the complete cusp of in the middle of a revolution right now. And I think there's a couple of things that are important to that. One is that if you were to start an agency today, knowing everything you know about the world, how would you do it? And I think what we're building, we're not agency first. It's kind of an afterthought. But the reality is we're starting to win and pick up credible projects. And we're able to do that in a way that's like AI native, not only in terms of the tooling we use within our own organization, just the way in which we structure the teams, communicate, leverage tools in our own like day-to-day efficiency, but also in terms of the tools that we're leveraging to create the end product. Honestly, I think it's a radically different business model to the existing agencies today, which are obviously multi-billion dollar companies. So, you know, I think there's a huge opportunity there. And I think just abstracting out from Wonder and the space that we particularly play in, you know, I think that it is the new internet. And I think often of, you know, to take it back to Deliveroo and restaurants, you know, when the internet started, how many years later was it when every restaurant suddenly had a website? And how many years after that was it that every restaurant was then doing delivery? You know, I think we're literally at the very beginning of the new internet, where there's still actually just a handful of people that are actually using these tools to their full potential, and maybe not even then. But in terms of the broader economy and actually like leveraging the power that's already been unlocked today, we are nowhere near. And I think advertising is just one, or, you know, just media, game creation, film creation, advertising is just one of those vectors. But in reality, I think basically every industry is about to go through its own kind of internet-style revolution as they start to embrace and actually unlock the power of these tools to their full potential.
I love that sort of tracing the possible outcomes. Yeah, at one end, you've described it. So that's basically an agency, but it's AI native, which it's going to be able to create as much more content, unique content, much cheaper than the market. And that's a great business, period, right? The other end, you think about what's the compounding advantage you could build with, you know, your own use of technology in innovative ways. And the example that came to mind was Pixar. Like, Pixar is a huge business because they figured they pioneered a new technology in their era. It was animation, for Toy Story, you know, the early animated flicks. And they didn't sell their animation capacities to others necessarily. They used that, and they've sort of pioneered this whole new category. I'd say perhaps the environment they were operating in is different. Today, AI companies are reliant heavily on underlying models. So there's a lot of unique and creative things you can do with the underlying model, but ultimately somebody else, OpenAI, Anthropic, whoever it might be, is building that, or 11 Labs, and you're building the piece on top. I'm curious how you think about that dynamic, as like you are building in an environment where the tools available to you and everybody else changes rapidly. What are you doing to ensure that your unique advantage, your defensibility, everything that makes Wanda special stays ahead of those underlying models and sort of the broad capacity they provide?
It's a great question. I actually think that's one of our superpowers, the fact that the space is changing so quickly. We are entirely laser light focused on the craft. We want to be, to the jewelry analogy I gave earlier, we want to be like the best artisans. We want to be the best craftsmen in terms of taking the underlying properties, the underlying technology, and bringing something to life. And that necessitates being across the changing models. It means being on the kind of bleeding edge of what's happening. Now, we're very lucky because, you know, we're obviously backed by the founder of 11 Labs. We've got a strong partnership with them. We've got a strong partnership with Freepik, where would, you know, if the head of startups at OpenAI as an investor, same with DeepMind. So we've got incredible ecosystem kind of play, and we're plugged into a lot of the major kind of underlying AI businesses, but we're really focusing on the stuff that they aren't building, which is, you know, the craft of taking that underlying product, using all of them to create something ultimately that people want to consume, and providing that to the kind of traditional creative agencies in industries. So I think the fact that it's constantly changing is actually one, you know, just in terms of the time we've been doing this, when I see the quality of the output, the stuff that we're actually creating, it's just growing exponentially. So I think we're a beneficiary. That's a tailwind for us in terms of the output. And it's also a bit of a moat in terms of the fact that it's hard to stay on top of all this stuff. And I think the reason that the community is so powerful is one of the main reasons that our community is so active is because the world leaders in the space are constantly posting updates, posting new tools, discussing what's happening here. And that conversation is happening within our business. So I think we're extremely fortunate to kind of have that access to understand, like, these are how the tools are shaping the world, and this is what's coming down the pipe, and then leveraging it to ultimately create like a great product for consumers.
If there's a revolution going on around us in every industry, if you couldn't work on this problem, if you couldn't work on advertising and building the business you are, what's the next most interesting space that you'd be applying your skills?
You know, it's funny, like, I don't have a good answer because I'm just so excited. I'd say advertising is a sub-product. We're literally shaping the future of entertainment. And I just think, like, and the thing is, I love storytelling, as you can tell. I love storytelling. It's all about storytelling, ultimately. I think, you know, many things in life come down to storytelling. And the fact that we get to shape that work on it day to day, work with incredible writers and storytellers to bring visions to life. I personally, I honestly, it's hard to think of anything else I'd want to work on. Maybe music. Obviously, I love music. That's like a passion project for me. But I've kind of done my time as a mercenary, and I'm excited to do my time as a missionary. You know, I was a mercenary at Deliveroo and Turo, even though I was, you know, was very grateful for my opportunity to work there, and I loved the people there, and I had a great time. I was building ultimately someone else's dream, and I wasn't that excited about car rental or food delivery. But the power to kind of craft the future of storytelling and work with amazing creatives, it's so much fun.
That's awesome. How about the financing piece of this puzzle? So if you're all in on the creative, on the future of entertainment, you've also kind of the tire thread that we haven't got to talk about yet in here. Lumiere Ventures, if I'm pronouncing that right, was your fund that is investing in film rights. So you've now got the perspective on sort of the front end of the stack, creating the entertainment, and also on the back end of the stack, financing the entertainment. Can you give us a quick backstory on Lumiere and correct my pronunciation? And also, where is that piece going? So how do you think about the future of financing? Are you going to continue doing that piece as you go forward?
Yes, correct. So Lumiere, like light in French, like a Lumiere brothers who like apparently invented film. But so it's a great question. So the Lumiere stuff actually was what convinced me with Wonder we were on to something that was going to change the world. Because I was seeing firsthand the challenges in the financing world of film.
Can you describe those? Like how is a film financed quickly? The 101 version.
Of course. Yeah, I mean there's many different ways films are financed, but the specific place that we play in as Lumiere Ventures, and to kind of answer all the questions in one, that's run by a very good friend of mine, my business partner, Richard Lechartier, French guy, hence Lumiere, who kind of manages that business day to day. So it will continue to run. But, you know, I'm kind of a backseat driver, so to speak. But that particular business in terms of how we finance the films, you know, obviously I was very lucky to partner up with Richard, who's been in the industry for like 30 plus years. Kind of does this in his sleep, and it's a very simple business model. We will focus on a particular type of film where we know it well, we know the space, and that's typically a kind of action film that's from a large independent producer, typically out of, you know, Hollywood, but we can be anywhere. But we'll focus on, you know, one of our first film was Arcadian with Nick Cage. We just did a Stallone film called Armor. We just did a Daddy Dyer film, which is coming out soon, very exciting. But it's a very simple kind of financing model. If they're not a major studio, one of the ways in which a independent studio will raise the finances to make the film is they will carve out certain territories and they will pre-sell the rights. So it gets a little bit complicated, but...
Like geographic territory. So you mean like you'll pre-sell the rights for New Zealand or Australia or something?
Exactly. And so if you imagine it this way, like the film's going to cost $20 million to make. They're going to raise that money from like a bank, film financing bank. But the bank is going to want to know that there's some revenue kind of guaranteed in the tank before they're releasing the $20 million. And so what they'll do is they'll take a concept, a script, a teaser. They'll go to one of the film markets and they'll pre-sell the rights to that film in that market, like New Zealand or France or whatever it is, for a certain amount of money. And so Lumiere kind of plays in that space of buying the rights, so taking, you know, quite a bit of risk up front, but buying the rights for a certain territory, and then when the film is made, owning those rights. But often, you know, we would look to sell the rights, you know, flip the rights to a Netflix or an Amazon or a Sky or a Canal Plus. So it's kind of we're in the moving business, not the owning business, so to speak. But from that perspective, you know, I was seeing the challenges of, like, I've seen so many pitches, like being an investor, you see so many pitches of startups, and, you know, it's like there are actually so many good companies that don't get funded. And so there's the inverse, there's a lot of bad companies that do get funded.
A lot of bad movies that get funded as well, right?
Exactly. But, you know, what I was seeing firsthand was, like, there was so much talent, there was so many opportunities that couldn't get funding, couldn't get made. And the ones that did get made, like films notoriously go over budget. There's so much wastage. And so it kind of, you know, I just know enough people in the industry who are all kind of aware that they're being forced to do more with less on a faster timescale. But no one wants to get rid of the traditional craft. No one wants to replace, you know, actors, the actual like beauty of the art form. But if there's areas where you can enhance the process, you know, make it more efficient, you'd be crazy not to, because the industry is kind of in this existential threat, you know, unless you're a major, major studio that's prepared to lose money for years and years and years.
So Lumiere, to bring that to a point, buys the geographic rights to distribute a film, and then to do so, you're going to have to understand the quality of supply, obviously, on one side, and its ability to resonate with a geography or a specific demographic on the other. And if you get it right, you're able to sell those rights on to someone that pays a higher price once it's been de-risked. If you get it wrong, you might lose money. And across a portfolio, you're making a bet that the number of wins outweighs the number of losses with some kind of ROI. It's kind of a venture capital portfolio for geographic film rights. On track?
Yeah, absolutely nailed that. Now, I've explained that business to many people, and that is the best summary I've ever got. That was very good.
And you know this, but there's something about like drawing comparisons, anecdotes, yeah, between creative and technology. I think that these worlds are just colliding, and you'll see this more than anyone. The process of starting a startup is somewhat similar to the, you know, the process of becoming a songwriter to becoming a film producer. It's all about like, how do you break through the noise?
Storytelling.
Yeah. How do you refine storytelling? How do you refine your product to resonate with a given audience? Once you have, how do you get distribution? Once you have, how do you keep and build and compound more products? Once you have, how do you retain the cool as the fame, you know, goes to your head or not? It's fascinating to follow.
I think it's starts with storytelling, you know, across all three. Can you craft a story that people are going to believe in? Because at the beginning, that's all you can go on, belief, right? There's nothing. There's nothing other than belief. So you've got to try and manufacture belief out of nothing. And the only way to do that is through powerful storytelling. Then it goes to product market fit, which is where, you know, it's kind of in the lap of the gods. Now, you either survive long enough to figure it out or you get lucky. But, you know, if you can get to product market fit is the next big existential hurdle that people must overcome. And then the one after that is scale. And I've never gone past that. I'm guessing the last one is like legacy or like reinventing yourself or innovator's dilemma. You know, you hit scale and then you probably become bureaucratic and slow moving and obsolete. So how do you always keep reinventing? That would probably be the last one, but I would say storytelling, product market fit, and scale are like the three things that all three kind of have in common, and like existential hurdles that each category's got to leap if they're going to get to be a success.
There's different horses for courses, and I think the legacy piece is a different persona, at least for me anyway. I feel the early stages are more of a draw. Though that said, founder mode is all the rage these days. And, you know, in fact, maybe to reinvent yourself at scale, there would be an interesting skill set to develop. But you get to do it this time around with Wanda. Tell me to perhaps overuse this metaphor. You're talking to somebody young, very early in their career. They are a startup. What are they doing? Sorry, to be clear, career advice for the young person considering themselves a creator or a startup founder or wherever they might be, you know, coming out of college.
So this, I'm going to steal this from Naval, who's incredible. But basically he said something like, AI is not going to take your job. Someone using AI is going to take your job. Someone using AI better than you is going to take your job. And I think that is certainly true for the short to midterm. And so that would be my advice is just lean in on this technology. I think there's a couple. I mean, I actually wasn't. I was just extremely, I thought it all passed me by, if I'm honest. I was like, I had my time in the sun. I was kind of there when mobility was blowing up and food delivery, you know, I kind of had my fun. And I was like, this AI thing's too hard. You know, there's too many other people who are more expert at it than me. And then I was just so lucky to meet my co-founder, Justin, who's truly like a visionary and infectious energy with optimism with the tools and technology. And he's taught me a lot. And I think just so grateful that I've been able to like fall into this industry now and learn it. And I think my lesson there is like for the older people, but also for the young ones, it's not too late. Like I got asked this the other night at a dinner, and I said, you know, the way to think about it is the cards have just been reshuffled. So the people who are the most against this, the most anti the technology for the most part, are the ones that have the most to lose, right? Because they're the beneficiaries of the current power structures in society. They're the beneficiaries of years of hard work, of honing their skill set or honing their network or honing their, you know, modus operandi in a world where AI wasn't part of the equation. But all of a sudden, you know, this internet 2.0 has come along and all the decks have just been reshuffled. So for young people, I think it's an incredible opportunity because you have a once in a generation opportunity to basically rapidly accelerate through your career, because so many of the new jobs that are going to be so important in the next 5 years haven't even been created yet. And they're going to go to the people that lean into learning these tools. And I can give you just one example from the way that we're currently running the company. So, you know, we have someone working for us called Benny, who actually was an architect by training, incredibly smart guy. He has just, for whatever reason, like really lent into the tools and is a kind of a jack of all trades with like the different like creative elements of AI, but is also like incredibly good at vibe coding. All self-taught, all self-reinvented. And he's just so talented that we've just created a role in our company called the AI architect. And I really do think that this is going to be a new blueprint for how people are going to build successful companies. Because when I was, you know, coming up through Deliveroo and Turo, we would always be so frustrated at the length of the product cycles. You know, can we get this on the product roadmap? Then we need a team of designers. Then it needs to go to the engineers. You know, we are literally prototyping the Wonder app or the Wonder platform for our community in real time, and it's being led by Benny, our AI architect. And
very cool.
You know, without giving too much of the secret sauce away, the idea is that he is going to basically scope out the architectural plans for what the platform could look like, and then we're going to partner up with an engineer that can then go in and actually solidify those plans. But that in and of itself would have been impossible 3 years ago. So for the younger people listening, I would say like you're on the cusp of, yeah, once in a generation opportunity to completely leapfrog the people above you. Just lean into the tools.
It's really powerful. It's a really good place to bring this one and to land as well. With my final question, what can we do to help you? What asks do you have of the diaspora? Are you hiring? Now that you're out in the wild with Wonder announced, are you hiring? Are you looking for creative directors, producers, people that are, you know, looking to work with you, partner with you? What are the asks?
Well, thank you very much for giving me the platform. I'd say depends on where we're at when this thing goes live, but currently we're kind of pausing certain hires until we've gone live, and obviously want to leverage the kind of buzz that comes with that. But we're looking for a founding engineer, potentially one other engineer. We're looking for a chief of staff. We're looking for anyone who's like really passionate about creativity and filmmaking, who has a very strong grasp of the AI tools. So yeah, we're hiring basically. And if you're passionate about the mission and you're one of these people that I was talking about who's kind of just recently reskilled in the world of AI, we'd love to speak with you. And then other than that, you know, I think just putting the word out there, like, you know, if you see content that you love, we're going to be releasing, I can't say too much about it, but we're going to be releasing some of our own short episodes, films, as part of an anthology soon. So definitely check those out when they come out. We'd love the views and the feedback.
Excited to do that. Zav, that was fun. Thank you, sir. That was good. Yeah, excited to see this out in the world. And we'll have to do this again in a year or two's time to check on the progress, check on the state of the world at that point as well.
Hopefully we're all still in drums. And
yeah. Yeah. Oh, you will be. You will be. Thank you, sir. We'll speak soon. And that's a wrap. Thanks for listening. As a quick reminder, make sure you hit subscribe over in your favorite podcast player so you can keep getting stories like this landing in your feed every Friday to help power you through those weekend chores. For my day job, I'm an entrepreneur in residence and an investor at Blackbird Ventures. We're backing best Kiwi and Aussie founders, no matter where they are in the world, back home with global ambitions or out there building generational companies. My personal sweet spot is pre-seed and seed. I like to say there's no check too early, so drop me a line anytime. That's dbooth@blackbird.vc. This episode was produced by Day One, the podcast network for founders, operators, and investors, and is part of the Day One network. Thanks again. Look forward to seeing you back next week.